a husky voice, rather, low and hushed by weakness, and yet with its own soft harmony. Weldon found himself drawing a long breath, and guarding that breath, lest it should be obvious that he was moved.
"I've talked to him," Dr. Watts assured her. "Very briefly, my dear girl. He wanted to come up to see the place and the situation."
Worry clouded her brow a little.
"It isn't a very jolly place," she said. "It's far away from town and a hard ride. You have to consider that, Mr. Weldon, if you'll even think about coming to us."
Then, in order that he might have a chance to reflect on what she said, she murmured to the doctor,
"And when shall I make that ride again, Dr. Henry?"
Dr. Watts stood beside her, holding her hand. His naturally bowed shoulders gave him the appearance of leaning above her.
"In a few days, no doubt. In a very few days, beyond a doubt, my dear, you'll be in the saddle again, blowing the roses back into your cheeks."
"Really?" she said,
and lifted slowly to him the great dark eyes, with that faintest of smiles upon her lips. But it seemed to Weldon that the doctor had spoken with a most clumsy pretense, and that she had looked straight through at the truth. What was that truth? That she would never walk from that house again, or leave it in any way, except when she was carried to her grave? So thinking, Weldon could not help frowning a little. The girl noticed, and appeared to put a natural interpretation upon the look.
"Ah," she said, controlling her disappointment, "that is not all. That is not all against us. There would be no one to see and talk to very much. Dear Dr. Henry comes to me almost every day. He would be about all. There's poor Doggett. He's not much good. And old Aunt Maggie will soon tire you. And I'm not very gay, you see."
"You might paint the picture a little more cheerfully," broke in the doctor, almost with irritation. "There's no use in me bringing up a man all this distance, just to have you send him right about face at once." Weldon could have cursed that complaining voice. The doctor was old, indeed, to exercise such small control. The girl waited a little. She never spoke in haste, but always she seemed to consider for a moment what had last been said to her. So her gentle eyes now rested on the face of the doctor before she said,
"But you see, I don't want him to come lured by false pretenses, and then suddenly to find that it's such a drab, gray life. For if we had him here to protect us, oh, then it would be too sad to lose him again."
"You've started to draw the portrait," the doctor said with inexcusably childish irritation. "Now you might as well finish the picture and tell him just why we want him. I only hinted at the facts." She looked from Watts to Weldon. She said simply,
"We think that people are trying to enter the house and reach me."
Weldon could hardly speak. He managed to say, "To reach you?"
"The doctor saw someone in the hall the other day. The man didn't wait for questions. He went through a window. And then, a little before that, the lock of the rear door of the house was forced. But Maggie heard a noise, and when she came out from her room, footsteps slipped away."
"They've come into the house for plunder, then," Weldon said, turning cold. "Of course, that's the reason."
"There's nothing in my room worth stealing," said the girl. "You see."
It was, in fact, very plainly furnished. A few prints were on the walls. There was a common rag rug on the floor. Certainly the general had not overburdened his daughter and only child with too rank a luxury.
"I have no jewels, except a couple of rings and a few beads, you know," she said. "Everyone knows that I haven't other things."
"But were these men trying to get at your room?"
"The man the doctor saw was at my door, working at it with a skeleton key, he thought. But when poor Maggie came down the other time, The footsteps she heard went away from near my door also.
Weldon swallowed hard. He looked again at Helen O'Malley, and told himself that there were no men mean enough to wish to harm her. And then he hesitated. There were men, however, to whom nothing could appeal except money, however come at. She was turning on her finger a ring that was set with a small, pale sapphire, a brilliant on either side.
"And it's a whole week ago," the girl continued, that I think perhaps you had better tell him about that, Dr. Henry."
Her head fell back on the cushion, her eyes almost closed. Weldon cast a significant glance at the doctor, and the latter nodded.
"We'd better go," he whispered. "We're going to leave you alone for a little, Helen, to talk things over between ourselves. There's nothing you want?"
"No, nothing. You'll tell me the decision soon?"
"Yes." They withdrew. In the room of the general they sat down close to the window and heard an outbreak of that same harsh, racking cough that Weldon had heard before. "Why don't you do something?" he asked abruptly. The doctor shrugged his shoulders.
"There's nothing to be done," he answered almost dryly. "Cough mixtures, they'd simply make her sick, and, I'm afraid, cough mixtures would never stop that cough."
Weldon bit his lip and turned suddenly toward the window.
"Well, it's fatal, then?" he snapped across his shoulder. "The consumption? I don't know. I don't know. One never can tell. There's the chance always of a turn for the better. But there's not much fighting spirit in her. No resistance in the mind, you know. I don't think that she much cares."
"She ought to be made to care," Weldon said with resolution.
"Ah, my boy, and will you stay with her and prescribe, perhaps?"
"Stay here in the house? Man, man," Weldon said, "wild horses couldn't drag me away from it."
Chapter 12 The doctor stopped further talk by raising his hand. He turned and hurried into the next room. It seemed to Weldon that there was something almost subtle and guilty in the manner of Henry Watts, as though he wished to announce this decision of Weldon's before the latter had any chance to change his mind. From within the sick chamber, for the door had been left the slightest bit ajar, Weldon heard a low cry of joy, then the cough again. For some reason, it made him reach inside his coat and grip the handle of a Colt, but revolvers could do nothing against such an enemy as this. The doctor came back, actually rubbing his hands together in his exultation. Weldon said to him sharply, "You might consider, Dr. Watts, that this case isn't settled, even if we manage to keep the rats away from her. I think that girl is dying, and yet you can seem happy." It was rarely that Weldon was so outspoken. What he said seemed to depress the doctor very much, and he sat down, plucking at his beard.
"Of course, you're perhaps right," he said. "Only, one cannot help hoping, just as one cannot help praying, Mr. Weldon."
The big man lost all animus. He sat down in turn. "There was something else you were going to tell me," he said.
"And about what, pray?" said the doctor with absent mind. "I don't recall anything."
"The thing that was too much for the poor girl to tell me herself."
"Ah, that?
Of course, I must tell you. Shortly, too. That was 7 or 8 days ago, I think. There is always a glass of water at Helen's bedside, and when she drinks it, she usually puts a few drops of lemon in it. But that morning, when she wakened, she forgot the lemon, and when she tried the water, it had an odd taste. It took her thirst away in one swallow, and therefore she put the glass aside. I came early that morning by the grace of good fortune. She happened to speak of the odd taste of the water. I tried it myself. Afterward, I analyzed it.
I had other things to do. It was only yesterday that I finished the analysis.
From his coat he took a small vial and held it to the light. It appeared to contain a perfectly clear liquid to Weldon. The doctor shook it. From the bottom there rose a faint film. Some sort of precipitate, perhaps, was there.
"Arsenic," Dr. Henry Watts announced, his eyes thoughtful. "Arsenic," he repeated again. Then he looked down with a benevolent smile to the younger man.
"They tried to poison her? It's hard to believe," said Weldon.
He rolled a cigarette and lit it. He began to smoke in his own furious manner. He clouded the room almost instantly.
"Ah, yes, arsenic,"
the doctor said, dwelling strangely on the word.
"And a very neat solution of it at that. There's enough of this, for instance, to kill a dog. Enough in this little vial."
"And wasn't one swallow enough to almost kill that delicate girl?"
"You don't understand. This is not a common preparation. There is arsenic and arsenic, you must remember. It's been called the fool's poison. Ah, not in the hands of an artist. Not at all. Not at all."
The doctor actually laughed. He seemed to enjoy the theme, and Weldon wrote him down as more than a little childish in some qualities of his mind.
"I thought that arsenic always left traces in the body," he challenged the doctor's odd enthusiasm.
"Of course it does," admitted Henry Watts cheerfully. "But how many bodies are examined? And in these days of cremation, criminals may be sure that the evidence of their crimes will soon pass away in the fire that burns the victim. Oh, yes. Besides, there are kinds of compounds, as I was saying. One may give arsenic in such a way that the victim is nauseated. His head swims. It aches violently. He is afflicted with spasms. Well, those violent symptoms, of course, excite curiosity, and there is usually a post-mortem. Believe me, my dear young friend, arsenic is a fool's poison only when it is in the hands of a fool."
Weldon listened as to an authoritative voice. A scientific earnestness and surety appeared in the bowed, time-weakened doctor.
"This poison, for instance, would not have operated for several days. And then, when the drink of strange-tasting lemonade was quite forgotten, Helen would have fallen into a quiet sleep and never opened her eyes again. Poor child."
"But," Weldon objected, "you didn't know it was arsenic until yesterday?"
"I didn't know, but I suspected as soon as I had tasted that water myself. First I tasted it without lemon, and there was a faint taste, only perceptible, say, to a very fine palate like Helen's, or to a man with professional understanding of such things. Add even 2 drops of lemon juice, and all the taste disappears at once."
Weldon nodded. He was beginning to admire this old man, and he was rather amused to note the manner in which Henry Watts lost his almost crushed humility and spread his elbows at the board once he dipped into a scientific theme.
"Of course I gave antidotes at once, gradually, from day to day, and now Helen will feel not even a trace of the poison."
"Interesting, most interesting," Weldon said. "And you haven't an idea about the persons who tried to do this trick?"
"Ah, the same ones who twice were caught in the house, no doubt of that."
"Ones? One man I think you found each time."
"Yes, but not the maker of the poison, or he who administered it."
"You're sure of that?"
"Certainly. As sure as I am that there still is lightning somewhere in heaven."
"Will you tell me why?"
"At once. Those were rude bunglers. They betrayed themselves by the noise they made. But this other, this man—"
He shook the little vial and smiled upon it with the most singular appearance of affection.
"This man is as secret as death itself. He steps without sound. He passes more softly than a shadow. A wise, talented, gentle spirit, no doubt."
Weldon withheld comment.
No doubt, the doctor went on thoughtfully, as he leaned above that beautiful girl. He blessed her loveliness. He rejoiced, let us say, that he was sending her out of this world, before time had stained her ever so little.
Ah? Weldon murmured politely.
But afterward, when the poison did not take effect, he would not willingly run the risk of entering the house a second time in person, and he dispatched to the place a hired man who failed, and another hired man who likewise failed. But sooner or later, this original genius will come again. Perhaps you will see him, Mr. Weldon.
I hope so, Weldon said grimly.
If you can lay hands upon him, treat him gently for my sake.
Enlarge that idea, little doctor, if you please.
Because before he dies, I should like to talk to him, dip into his cultivated mind, taste the beauty of his soul. I am growing poetic.
The doctor chuckled. A little, admitted Weldon. To a scientific inquirer, said the doctor in rather a changed tone, as though taking more heed of his audience, even the most hideous germ is a splendid spectacle.
But this poison intrigues me. Arsenic, the fool's poison. What fools they are to call it so.
He turned a little and confronted Weldon more squarely.
Do you know that once there were more brands of arsenic poison than there are brands of wine in modern France?
Weldon did not reply. There was no need. The old fellow was off in the midst of an enthusiastic lecture.
In the great Italian days, Dr. Watts said, when men lived a lifetime in half a dozen years, and when lives, as you may say, were therefore trebly worth taking, they understood how to compound these poisons. Arsenic, thrice refined. They would poison cattle and draw from the dead body a frightfully potent serum, and this again produced death, and death fortified death mysteriously. The secret has been lost. We only in a general way know the results. We know that men challenged to a duel suddenly dropped dead. Fear and excitement, said the spectators, and buried him. They did not think that the excitement, combining with the poison, was indeed fatal, but only with that assistance. Or again, a man drank wine in the evening, and died the instant he tasted food the next day. Poisoned food? It is examined, what is left of it, and found perfectly innocent. The hand of God, say the medical men. They were like that, those old criminals. They imitated the hand of God, its mystery, its silence, its strength. But I've spoken of only crude and rude effects. They could proceed with wonderful delicacy. You dine in my palace. On the morrow you travel from Rome to Florence, and when that dinner is days and days forgotten, suddenly you sicken.
Fever, says one physician. The heart, says another. You die.
Very well. There were other kinds.
Sometimes when the victim was close at hand, with the utmost delicacy, the potions were graduated. From month to month, the poor sufferer sickened. He passed into a decline. A change of air was prescribed. He departed for a journey. In France or Egypt, his strength left him, and he died in his bed. Poison? It was never dreamed of. But show me the modern touch that can equal these old things. Show me the aconite, the prussic acid, so handled that it produces such artistic results.
Weldon nodded. He was vastly interested. He began to feel that there were infinitely more pages to the nature of the doctor than at first he had dreamed. But then, it is always true of the withdrawn scholar that his enthusiasms are strange, and unlike those of the ordinary man in the street.
And this unknown man, this
fiend who tried to poison Helen O'Malley. You think he had that lost art, eh?
He?
Not altogether. Oh, no, but this is not any great triumph of the art. However, it is something out of the ordinary. And there is enough to this compound to make me believe that something more than walls and bars and a decrepit negress and a doddering old serving man are necessary to keep the life in the body of beautiful Helen. Would you not agree to that?
With all my heart, Weldon answered. Then he added, I don't know what you people know of me. I'm afraid that you're taking me a little too much for granted. I take it that I'm not one of the world's blackest scoundrels, but at the same time I've lived more on the wrong than on the right side of the fence. I have more training in getting away from trouble with the law than in helping to trace out a clever crime.
My dear, dear friend, said the smiling doctor.
Let me finish. The other night I had a bit of an adventure in San Trinidad. That may have made me seem very clever in your eyes. I'm not. Frankly, I'm not. I have an extraordinarily strong pair of hands. My nerves are fairly steady, and I shoot a bit closer to the center than a good many. But, Doctor, I've never succeeded in accomplishing any really extraordinary thing in my life. And if we're matched here against some unusual criminal, I give you my word that I advise you with all my heart to call in a talented worker. I'll assist him if he wants assistance, or I'll stay here and play watchdog. That's what I earnestly suggest that you do.
The doctor, his brows puckering up a little, regarded Weldon long and calmly. It was an odd characteristic of Henry Watts that, although he generally kept his eyes upon the ground, when he raised them, those eyes were able to look straight into the heart of another. So he seemed to be looking at Weldon now, as at the page of a book, reading busily. He was not able to conceal that he was rather alarmed and worried by what he saw. He began to shake his head ever so little.
"I see that you're an honest man, Weldon," he said. "Don't protest that you're not. But for the time being, we have you and we want you. If, I beg your pardon, but if we should decide that after all we must try to get someone else, that is to say,
Weldon smiled. "The moment you make up your mind as to that," he said, "of course I'm ready to go." The doctor sighed and smiled. He stretched out his hand and shook that of Weldon with a good deal of heartiness.
"We're going to get on. We're going to get on," he said. "I haven't the least doubt that you're the man for us. Not the least doubt in the world. Now we'll go and fix you in your room. But first, you'll want a drink of something. We have some old wine in the cellars. If you—"
"Thank you," answered Weldon. "I've stopped drinking. I'll have nothing whatever while I'm here."
The doctor turned on him with a vague astonishment. He seemed about to protest, but then shook his head and led the way. Chapter 13 It was a comfortable room, plainly furnished, like all the chambers in the house, in which there appeared nothing eccentric, except the apartment of the general himself. On one side of it opened the library. On the other side was the room of Helen O'Malley, from which the old servant, Doggett, with the assistance of Weldon himself, soon rigged a bell rope, communicating with a little brazen bell at the head of Weldon's bed. One touch of the bell rope, therefore, would bring him to her aid. Her door was locked, to be sure, but he was furnished with a key, so that he could enter in the case of a desperate call for help. This appeared to Weldon not at all an ample security. He suggested accordingly that the other door from her room, that is to say, the one into the chamber of her father, should be secured firmly and at once, and that heavy bars should be placed across her two windows. To this the doctor seemed about to agree, when he recollected himself.
"We'll have her in a state of nervous collapse before there's the slightest danger of an attack being made on her," said the doctor.
"Doctor," said Weldon, "that girl has stronger nerves than you think. It's physical weakness that bothers her, not weak nerves.
I have an idea that she has her share of courage.
Dr. Watts seemed greatly surprised at this statement. Neither did he seem highly pleased with Weldon or the latter's remark, and it was very much as though he felt that to attribute courage to his patient was equivalent to calling her unfeminine. However, Weldon was firm. As he pointed out, there were four means of ingress into that guarded room. Only one was through his door. Besides this, there were two windows to which one might climb either with a ladder or without one, by means of the strong vines that were rooted in the wall, or by holding onto the rough projections of the wall itself. And in addition, there was the door from the general's room to that of his daughter. Of what use was it to guard the one door if the others were only secured with bolts and locks? The doctor finally agreed. There happened by good chance to be a few sacks of cement, though rather old, already on the place. There was plenty of iron junk, and plenty also of stout planks. The doctor took Helen O'Malley in her invalid chair to another room where she could sit in the sun. Then Doggett, the man of all work, came to help Weldon at the labor of sealing the room. It was not a great task. The planks were spiked in place across the general's room from Helen O'Malley's side. A curtain hung over these planks by Aunt Maggie concealed them well enough. She went darkly about this work, glowering at Weldon from time to time. Old Doggett was far more willing. He was a cheerful, simple-minded fellow who had been at sea for many years, until a fall from a loft on the main yard had nearly knocked the life out of his body and left him with a crooked back. He could no longer run up the rigging, so he had begun work ashore, and, as he said, had found life on dry land all doldrums or Cape Stiff weather, until at last he made harbor with the general and came to anchor, as he hoped, for the rest of his days. He was a gentle fellow, of 60 or so, but very fond of referring to wilder and grander days, when many a time he had been the first man aloft to the topgallant yards. He had tasted life on the Hooghly, on the China coast, in the gay ports of old Australia, and now his pleasure was chiefly in stuffing his pipe with sliced-up plug tobacco and smoking it slowly, comfortable in the reek and the stench of it, while he remembered the great days of sail and the adventures under canvas. Like all sailors, he was a handy man, and therefore he was quite at home working with Weldon on the window bars. Holes had to be chiseled deep into the rock. Little physical labor had come the way of Weldon, but he had done some mining, and experience with a jack and a drill now helped him quickly to sink deep pits. Then the iron bars, previously sawed off from bits of varying sizes in the junk heap, were inserted, and the cement worked all around to secure the grip. When this was done with both the windows, the day was growing old, and Weldon freely admitted to Doggett and the doctor also that what had been accomplished was really not enough to keep the room from being entered. But he was equally sure that no one could drag down those bars without making such a noise that the soundest sleeper would be wakened and given ample time for raising an alarm. This rough work was then covered with a coat of gray paint, and Weldon sat down with a sore hand and a more placid conscience. He felt that at least he had interposed one hurdle between Helen O'Malley and danger. She was put to bed by Aunt Maggie at sunset each day, and this evening she asked to see Weldon. He found her looking pale even against the white of her pillow. The golden light of her curls at one shoulder made the contrast the greater, and her eyes were wonderfully large and dark. She seemed too feeble to make much of a move to greet him, so he came close to the bed and leaned a little above her. Then she said in that soft voice, with the tell-tale trace of huskiness in it, "Days and days and days I've wanted something across those windows, and I didn't even know it until you put the bars up, Mr. Weldon. I'm going to sleep tonight, for the first time in so long, so long." Weldon went out of the room with a full heart, and found his supper waiting for him in the library, for that adjoined, as has been said, his own room, and the sound of the bell was clearly audible there. The doctor, who had remained all the day, came in for a last moment of talk. He begged Weldon under no circumstances to make any noise. Miss O'Malley might sleep as sound as exhaustion could devise a slumber, or again she might be wakened instantly by the faintest scratch.
"She'll never complain," said the doctor. "As long as you're here, you'll never hear an unkind word from her, or a complaining one. You'll have to consult yourself, therefore. Move like a cat, Mr. Weldon, after the sun goes down. Never disturb her or tap at her door, no matter what you have to say. Wait until the next day for that."
Weldon agreed, willingly enough. Then the doctor took his hand in both of his.
"Heaven bless you, dear boy," he said, "for your goodness and your kindness to us. I know that Roger Cunningham would give you many and many $1,000 to work for him. But stay here, follow your conscience, and perhaps heaven will make up the difference."
The good doctor was so moved with the sterling worth of Weldon that there were even tears in his eyes as he spoke. Then he left the room and went down the hallway with a faltering step. Chapter 14. It was with Weldon as with a skipper who sees the last of the stevedores tumbled over the side of the ship, and the pilot cast off, and the owner's last message ended. With the closing of the front door that announced the departure of the doctor from the house, Weldon was alone in command. He had for crew a dour-faced old negress and a crippled sailor. His cargo was the life or death of lovely Helen O'Malley, and the very certainty that death would not be long delayed from her at any rate made the keeping of her from foul play all the more important to him. As for the voyage he was to steer, he had no doubt that dangers would come rushing upon him fast enough. He sat down to his supper, but presently he was aware that both the library windows looked straight in upon him. He got up from the table and went to them. The wall was stiff and straight beneath him, but the green vines swept up it like clinging spray, and there was the same rough masonry by which a man might climb. He lingered there a moment. The sun was well down, only the horizon was softly banded with color, and the stars were beginning to shine, thin and weak, except where Venus hung, a ball of golden fire. Up from the vines, the sweetness of their blossoms rose to him, and Weldon dreamed a little, and let his thoughts fly south to the lights of San Trinidad. Even at that distance, he could see their long, pale hands upon the surface of the river. He could not help but think of Francesca LaGuardia. Where was she now? Where was she bound, wild as a bird of prey, as keen, as swift, as beautiful? The heart of Weldon ached a little. From both those girls, the invalid and the criminal, he had a touch of the same emotion. For both were lost beyond human help, it seemed. But one of them was eternally lost as well. Aye, and he could not say that he wanted to be with her in order to save her from herself. He went slowly back to the table and was about to sit down when the bell jangled. He hastened, his heart in his throat, to the door of Helen O'Malley's room. It was not unlikely that there would be an attempt at this very moment, a cleverly chosen moment, before the new guard had settled to his vigil. He wrenched the key around in the lock, but the door was fast. There was no further ringing of the bell. Desperately he gave the door his shoulder. An iron bolt tore with a screech from its fastening, and he flung himself into the room, revolver in hand. He saw the pale glow of the bedside lamp, and the paler face of Helen O'Malley beside it. Nothing else, at the first sweep of his eyes.
"What is it?" Weldon said savagely. "What has happened? What frightened you?"
He was beside her, not looking at her. The one mighty hand hovered above her, as though instinctively to ward off a blow directed at her fragility, and in the other hand his revolver was ready. With his eyes he searched the corners of the room, the fluttering curtain, the deep hollows of the windows.
"What have I done?" murmured the girl. "There was nothing, only—"
Weldon jerked himself erect and turned to her. "Forgive me," he said. "Of course you simply wanted me to do something for you. But I thought, at first, I—" She completed the thought for him bravely and steadily.
"You thought someone was here? Of course you thought that. And you came, like a lion. It would have been a dreadful thing if another man had been here. I don't think you would have stopped to ask questions."
He allowed himself one deep, deep breath. "I'm not usually like this," he said. "But then, I'm not accustomed to such a thing as this. As soon as I get more settled into the thought that men really could try to harm you. Well, in the meantime, I'm sorry I came like such a fool. But why was the door bolted as well as locked?"
"Poor Aunt Maggie," said the girl. "That was she, no doubt. Just old custom made her do it."
"There's nothing I can do for you?"
"No."
He was withdrawing, but as he reached the door, she said in that faint voice, it barely reached him,
"I haven't told you why I rang. I'll be more careful another time. But a moment ago I thought—" It was a sort of wild, foolish, giddy feeling. "That you had gone. That you had left the house, Mr. Weldon. And that I was alone in it again with Aunt Maggie and old Doggett."
When he was back at his cooling supper, he sat down with a scowl on his brow. His heart was still racing from the shock of that summons, but it was not that which kept the thoughtful frown on his forehead. She had felt that he had left her the moment before. Was it not at that very moment that his thoughts had been flying south to San Trinidad and Francesca LaGuardia? Well, there is such a thing as mental transference, he argued with himself, only this was a strange and quick proof of it. And it gave Weldon a melancholy pleasure to think that so quickly there had been established between him and that poor girl a sympathy so profound and so sensitive. If only he could step into her mind as she had stepped into his, it would be hard indeed if the machinations of even the most subtle poisoner could reach her life. Aunt Maggie came wheezing to the library door just as he finished dragging the table to a place where the windows did not command it so easily.
"Did I hear something up here? Wasn't there some kind of a screeching and a screaming up here?"
gasped Aunt Maggie. She had her hand pressed close against her flowing skirt. The Weldon had a glimpse of a cleaver weighty enough for the felling of a bullock. He was pleased at the sight of it, more pleased than he had been before with her black, sour face. But he raised a finger and pointed at her. "You bolted the door of Miss O'Malley, the door that opens onto my room."
"What door is there left to bolt?" the cook asked fiercely. "Besides, I didn't bolt it. How could I? How could I leave the room after bolting a door like that? Could I go reaching in through that door and shove the bolt home? What for are you talking to me like that, Mr. Weldon?"
"The door was bolted. I had to break it open," he told her.
"If that door was bolted, you couldn't bust it open," she declared confidently. "I know what them bolts is fastened with."
He looked calmly at her, more calmly than he felt. After all, she was right in the first place. The door could not have been bolted from the inside, unless Helen O'Malley left her bed to do it. And that, of course, was unthinkable. Who, then, had slipped the bolt? The answer was simple. No one at all had slipped that bolt, but being made to work easily, being constantly used before, the jar of closing the door when the negress left the room had been sufficient to engage the tip of the bolt with its lodging place. "The door had to be broken open," he said dryly, to get rid of the negress. Aunt Maggie was not to be so discarded.
"What do you find to break it open with?" she asked.
"My shoulder."
Your shoulder," she said.
From disdain and scorn, her voice altered swiftly.
"Most like it ain't fat that you've got on them shoulders of yours, then," Aunt Maggie said.
She waddled a few steps into the room. The enormous breadth of her grin was sufficient to warm the heart of Weldon. It made up for her accustomed sulkiness.
"I'm just going to go back to the kitchen and thank the Lord that we got a man in the house after all these days," said Aunt Maggie. "But how'd the table come there?"
"I put it there," said Weldon. She glanced at the windows with sudden understanding.
"Well, sir, Mr. Weldon," she said, "I'm a mighty proud woman to be cooking for you, sir."
And she waddled off into the dimness of the hallway, her cleaver silver bright in her hand as she went. There was no fear in that heart of hers. Weldon smiled after her. He finished his supper and then turned his attention to the library. It was a collection of books after his taste, not fiction, but memoirs, odd bits of history, old bound magazine files, volumes of letters, biographies, and among the latter he found a fat tome that was the History of the O'Malleys. He sat down to that, greedily. Half the night he spent over it, while Aunt Maggie first removed his supper tray with a husky good night, and then left the house to him and that pulsing, whispering silence that pervades old places. It was an old family, that of O'Malley. It dawned upon Occidental history writers about the same time that Henry II began to send warriors to Celtic Ireland from Norman England, and thereafter the O'Malleys were in the midst of all the Irish struggles for freedom. In the days of Elizabeth, an O'Malley had even been honored with execution in proud London itself. After that, the details became more full. The O'Malleys were becoming a shade more civilized. They were leaving letters and memoirs from which the family history could be built up in detail. And what detail it was! They had done everything. They had been everywhere, soldiering chiefly. One had been a captain of the host at Perugia in the golden age of the fierce Baglioni, and had fought against a brother commanding a section of wild riders for Florence. And another had followed Constable Bourbon with a detail of Swiss pikemen. And another had marched under Gustavus, while his own cousin followed Wallenstein. One had led a column of steady English at Fontenoy, and another had charged with those soldiers of the Irish Brigade to beat them back. It seemed ever that way. The family was not large, but there were always enough of them to maintain the old nest in Ireland, from which went out a sufficient supply of fighters to strike on both sides with truly beautiful Irish logic. There was always a Protestant O'Malley to irritate his Catholic brothers. There was always an O'Malley in Spain to cross swords with an O'Malley in France. They had sailed the sea, and in every imaginable service there also. In short, the blood of the O'Malleys had been so rich and so wild that it was not strange to Weldon that the old general himself had been such a firebrand. There was nothing about him in this book. It had been written during his life, but his exploits were not detailed. Indeed, there was no need of that, for the O'Malleys were always the same steel. Not a one of them but loved fighting for its own sake. Not a one of them but was rich in invention, and usually poor in pounds. They were desperate enemies. They were desperate friends. They were cavaliers of high adventure. In addition, there was something to be said on a darker side. It was no wonder if the general had many enemies, if he were like the rest of his clan. Their wit, sometimes, was akin to dangerous cunning, and there was a sort of cruel craft about most of them. But the general was dead, and all that was left of the fire, the blood, the brain, the fury of the O'Malleys, was locked up in the body of that poor girl, now set about with enmities not of her making. The fire was burning low. It would soon be out, and the jewel of all the clan would be lost forever.
Chapter 15. When Weldon at last laid aside the book, it was past midnight. The air was cold and dead in the room, so he opened the shuttered window and leaned into the purer air of the night. He was not tired, he was not sleepy, for nature had given him the gift of accumulating rest as a camel accumulates fat, ready to be expended on long efforts of any kind. It was well, of course, to be within sound of the bell in the girl's room, but from what the doctor had said, he was more than reasonably sure that she would not call him. Like a good watchman, this was the time to make rounds. So he locked the library door, and that of his own room as well, and took the keys with him. He had on a pair of canvas shoes with rubber soles that made soundless walking an easy thing, even for a man of his weight. He had, in addition, an excellent bull's-eye lantern, small, but throwing a strong ray of light that he very well knew how to manipulate. The hall itself was not a pleasant place for shaken nerves. There were two curtains breaking up its length, and these curtains stirred and shifted in an uncanny manner as little drafts worked at them. He would suggest to the doctor the next morning that they do away with these draperies. This house must be looked upon as a ship made ready for battle, and the decks must be cleared for action. There were two stairways, one from the middle of the hall, a broad flight of steps, turning in a really noble curve as it descended, and the other at the southern end of the hall, a narrow servants' stairs. He went down the smaller, if for no other purpose, to familiarize himself with all the passages of the house during the night. In the lower floor, at last, he began to explore from room to room. Most of the doors were locked. On the others he practiced the silence of his hand in turning the knobs, and then gradually pushing the door open. But this can be done so that even the rustiest hinges in the world will give forth not a sound. A door open, he would probe at the darkness inside, using the lantern so that a mere needle of light escaped. With that needle he dotted the chamber skillfully, here and there, and in an amazingly short time he knew what was in it. He had nothing particular to gain by this, except that he wanted to refresh himself in every lesson of stealth and subtle quiet that ever he had learned before. He was going into training, as it were, for the prosecution of this work, just as a man will go into training for a prize fight. And if he could bring mind and nerve and body to the proper pitch, he promised a keen struggle to those shadowy enemies of the girl. Stepping back from the door of the storeroom and closing it behind him, he had finished examining everything on the lower floor of the house. There remained a cellar of unknown size. A battered door opened upon it at the end of the corridor. On this he worked with equal care, and finally he was able to open it soundlessly, as he thought. A steep, damp flight of steps pitched down before his eyes. It was evidently well below the level of water, for streaks of moisture appeared on the walls, and on the stone steps were traces of moisture, even little flat pools in the hollows of the stones, with the single ray of the lantern dripping across them. Felt slippers, he observed to himself, would be better for this sort of work of exploration than the rubber soles, which would be sure to slip on wet stones. However, he was firm on proceeding with this exploration. He kept close to the outer wall, because it gave him an easier way of getting slowly and carefully around every corner of the winding steps. And so he went down as though 10 tigerish foes were crouching for him on the way. He was very happy. What the fiery red sauce of San Trinidad was to his appetite, such was a touch of danger to his somewhat phlegmatic nature. He reached the first turning of the stairs and was about to continue, when he decided to fling another ray from the lantern before him. No larger than a thread was that little point of light that he cast before him, and it fell straight upon a man's face coming up the stairs from below. Instantly his thumb flicked the shutter wide open, and the stairs were filled with a shaft of light, and through that light Weldon aimed his revolver at Dr. Henry Watts. The poor doctor clung to the side of the stairs with a hand thrown up before his face, and distinctly Weldon heard him murmur, "Heaven receive my soul." Plainly the doctor thought that his last moment had come. "It's I," Weldon announced. The doctor did not seem to understand. His brain was numbed with horror until Weldon descended to him and touched his shoulder. Then he shuddered violently and seemed to waken.
I thought,
he began.
"Weldon,"
he said then, and fumbled at the arm of the younger man, as though to reassure himself of his actual presence.
"But you are up in your room beside poor Helen, listening for the sound of her bell. How can you be down here, Weldon?"
"Suppose I ask you why you are here," returned Weldon, his smile not at all pleasant to see. "Did you leave something behind you?"
"I had a thought," explained the doctor in his earnest manner, "that the reason they searched in the cellar of the house might be that they hoped—"
He paused and ran a hand over his mouth and down through his straggling beard, as though amazed that he should have spoken such words. "I don't want any secrets that are unnecessary," Weldon said. "I don't want to force you to talk, Dr. Watts." The doctor hesitated and then shrugged his shoulders.
"Helen wanted to tell you everything from the first. She was right. It was no use bringing you here unless we were to tell you whatever we know. Come down here with me."
Weldon followed him. They had reached a lower corridor, apparently directly under the main hall of the house. This passage had been worked in solid rock. Soft rock it was. Exactly what its nature, Weldon could not tell, but the surface, at least, was very dark, and there were marks of pick strokes more than a foot long. They had broken out this ground as though it were little harder than earth. He saw doors on each side. One of these the doctor opened, and Weldon saw before him an irregularly shaped room. The rays of his lantern refused to penetrate to the farthest corners. Deep, deep into the mountainside it extended, with high racks everywhere. The majority of them were empty, but there were quantities of dust-covered bottles.
"The general made wine an extravagance," said the doctor. "You see how thoroughly he did it."
He closed the door and went straight down to the end of the corridor.
"Now you'll see what Helen wanted to show you at once, while I, forgive me, thought it would be better to wait until we knew you a little better."
"I understand that," replied Weldon. The doctor leaned. At the sheer face of the rock he fumbled for a moment, and then stepped hastily aside. Weldon saw a mass of stone a foot across lean slowly, and then fall suddenly with a clink. It opened out like a folding shelf. Inside there was a little cavity.
"Now you see," said the doctor.
Weldon, on his knees, was pouring light into the interior of the hole. He stood up and dusted his knees.
"When the general died," Dr. Watts said, "he should have left a big fortune to Helen. But there was almost nothing, as I told you. Now, sir, we have proofs that he converted large sums into cash. And this was a hiding place for his wealth. As he grew older, he came to distrust banks. I have no doubt that in this house the old general had secreted hundreds of thousands of dollars before the end came upon him."
"And how was this found?" Weldon asked curiously.
"In a strange way. It was 2 months after the death of the general. The tomb he wanted cut into the face of the mountain had been completed, and his body was placed in it, when a heavy earthquake shook the house. Going down to see if the foundations had been injured in any manner, we found that this shelf of rock had opened. Inside there was this cavity, empty as you see it now. But when Helen came down to see it, she said at once she was sure that after the death of the general, someone had opened this place and stolen the contents. It seemed likely."
"You didn't have any suspicions?"
"Suspicions, yes, but that's hardly the point at present."
"I don't know a more important point," Weldon said dryly.
"I mean to say, I can tell you about them afterward. We took it for granted that the entire fortune had disappeared from this hiding place. But still, attempts continued to be made upon the house, beginning a short time ago. Why? Because there is still more money hidden away somewhere, and that money the thieves are after."
"Do they expect to find it in the room of Helen O'Malley?"
Ah, but you see, the point is this. If they kill her, the house is then closed for a time, at least. It's not likely that many purchasers would be found for a lonely building such as this, lost in the mountains and the pines. Let the house once be closed, and then the scoundrels will come to pillage it. They know that they cannot lay their hands on it at once, but they want freedom for a long search.
The anger of the doctor and his scorn and rage against these villains made his voice rise higher. There was even a sort of fire in his eyes as he spoke. Then he went on.
Tonight I had a sudden thought. The general was apt to do things symmetrically. Might he not have put a similar treasure chest at the farther end of the hall? We had sounded the walls all over, but I thought that I remembered a little rough projection.
He closed the stone shelf over the aperture and took Weldon to the farther end of the hall. There was, to be sure, a slight swelling out of the wall, and this the old man tapped.
You see, I have the place blueprinted in my mind, but I was wrong here. Sound the wall for yourself, and there's nothing, and under a glass you see nothing more, either.
Weldon tried for himself. Around the empty hiding place there was visible a very thin line, but then it had been opened many times, while the other hiding place, if another there were, had never been opened since the day when the general first sealed it and carefully covered up the marks of the chisel. He stood up again and turned to the doctor.
"You're a man with a sound mind, Dr. Watts," he said. "You seriously believe that there is money hidden away in this house?"
"No," said the doctor gravely. "But there are three possibilities. The general may have squandered a great part of his money in unknown ways, or he may have put it all away in the other crypt yonder. Or failing either of the first two possibilities, there may indeed be another portion of money, twice as great as the first even, hidden somewhere in the walls or the cellar of the house, or perhaps in the caves of the mountain."
Then, Weldon said, why not tear down this house to the foundations and search every stone?
Are you and I to do the work alone? The doctor asked, smiling. And if we don't, how are we to find other men who we could trust in such a search?
He added, besides, to dig down through these foundations of solid rock and open up all the wall surface would cost $100,000, and even then, the money might not be found, might not be here. Weldon was silenced. He suggested that the doctor come up with him to his room, and Henry Watts agreed willingly. Chapter 16 When they came into his room, Weldon lit the wood in the fireplace. The doctor, in the meantime, paced up and down the chamber. And as the smoke first rolled out, and then the flame began to catch and sing, Weldon looked at the old fellow with increasing respect. Only the body of the doctor was feeble. His brain was lively enough. He was no hero, and yet he had courage enough to leave his own cottage in the middle of the night and come here for the purpose of examining the damp, cold, dark cellar of a house where, as he knew, there might be untold dangers. Now, however, the doctor was not thinking of buried treasure and its possible hiding places, for he presently stopped in his pacing and said to Weldon,
"There she lies, wide awake, listening to the night noises, praying for the daylight to come, and yet never uttering a single complaint."
"Doesn't she sleep well at night?" Weldon asked anxiously.
"You will see. She sleeps hours in the day. At night I'm sure that she hardly closes her eyes. I try to make her confess, but she will smile and say that the night passed off very well. However, I have ways of telling."
He nodded his old head with a frown.
"What ways of telling, Dr. Watts?"
"The books she reads, and the number of them that she gets through," said the doctor. "You can't read big, solid volumes in a moment between sleeping and waking."
"Then why don't we see if she's sleeping now?" asked Weldon. "It's a frightful thing for even a strong man to lie awake night after night. It would fray the nerves of Hercules thin, not to mention the nerves of a sick girl. There should be someone to talk to her.
amuse her in some way. He stepped toward the door, but the doctor threw up his hand in haste.
Wrong, wrong, he said.